This podcast episode has been created for educational and informational purposes and should not be construed as medical, legal, or ethical advice. When seeking such guidance, please use established routes via your trust, defence union, or other relevant body. The opinions expressed here are those of the speakers and may not reflect the views of the RCOA or the institutions they are attached to. Hi there, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Anesthesia On Air, and in particular, our new Ethics and Law mini-series within it. I am Paul McConnell, and I'm a consultant in anesthesia and critical care based in Scotland, and a member of the Royal College of Anaesthetists Ethics Committee. It's my absolute pleasure to have with me here today, Sevan Amit. She's with Field Fisher, where she's a solicitor and legal director. Sevan, it's lovely to have you with us.
Thank you for having me. I'm a solicitor. I've been practicing in medical negligence for many years. I represent claimants who have been injured via medical negligence or personal injury.
Brilliant. Now, we've already recorded an episode with Dr. Anna Nelson, who gave us a great academic overview of consent and the sort of idealized version of it. But sometimes things at the coalface can't be quite as ideal. Maybe from your perspective as somebody who's assisted anaesthetists and doctors in court, what's your sort of overview of the consent process and the legalities?
So I'll be talking today about the law in practice. And what I thought would be helpful before we go into real discussion is, what is the core legal framework? So there's two tests. There's a professional practice test, and then there's the advisory test. And there's a distinction that needs to be made. So what is a doctor's role when considering possible investigatory or treatment options and the knowledge and identification of risks? And what law applies to that? So that is the professional practice test. And that's what we call BOLUM and BELIFO. So in order to identify what investigations or treatments or the identification of risks, the test is, what would a responsible body of anaesthetist identify in that position? And also BELIFO, any identification of treatment options or risks must be defensible and logical. So there's the case of McCulloch, which I'm sure your professor touched upon, in 2023, which involved a gentleman suffering a cardiac arrest and he passed away. And one of the central issues was the claimant's family argued that he should have been given beta blockers. The doctor presented other options and the court had to decide, well, whose judgment is it? Is it the doctor's judgment as to what are the reasonable treatment options, or does it fall to the patient? Do you have to present the patient with every possible treatment and let them decide? The court ultimately held that the identification of risk and possible treatment alternatives is a matter of professional skill and judgment. So it's what a body of responsible anaesthetists or doctors in that profession would have identified. And in that particular case, they said that the doctor's identification of reasonable treatment options were fine and they didn't have to identify beta blockers. So the claimant lost that case. So clinicians basically are not required to advise patients of treatment options that they don't consider to be reasonable. That's down to the clinician.
Yeah, so this is sort of to try and avoid, for want of a colloquialism, the tail wagging the dog.
Yes.
So a doctor should identify the reasonable treatment options with the caveat that doing nothing is always a reasonable treatment option. And then once they're identified, is that when, as Anne and I were talking about it, Montgomery really starts to come into play?
Exactly. So the first bit is the professional practice test. So that's you identifying the treatment options, the investigations and the risks. That's all down to the doctors. That's down to their professional practice. Then Montgomery comes in, and Montgomery is the advisory test. So what does the patient then need to be advised? And a patient under Montgomery needs to be advised of the reasonable treatment options that you have identified, the material risks, which means commonly occurring risks that you've identified, also rare risks, alternative treatments, alternative conservative measures or at doing nothing, and then talking to the patient about themselves as well and finding out a bit about them to obtain their informed consent.
So this idea of reasonable risks and the idea of materiality, certain patients will place material risks, certain risks higher than the others. So
yes,
the beloved example in anesthesia is an opera singer. And do you discuss the risks of intubation with yes. them? Is there any guidance on who decides what it's reasonable to discuss, or more accurately, how you would know that it was reasonable to discuss that with that patient?
I would need to check the GMC's guidance, because they offer really good guidance, actually. But one of the things I believe the GMC suggests as well is that you should have a discussion with your patient about, obviously, their comorbidities and their previous medical history, but also, what do they do for a living? What are their hobbies? And that kind of will bring out some of the information, what's important to them, what isn't. And that should enable you to identify what is material to that patient. Now, I appreciate you've only got a limited amount of time. So I'm not saying you have to sit there and have an hour discussion. It's what's reasonable in the circumstances to elicit in that 10 minutes. But it's about asking the appropriate questions. What do you do for a living? What are your hobbies? What's your everyday life like? Are you independent in daily activities of living? That should hopefully elicit the information you need to then enable you to understand what would be material to that patient.
I suppose that time pressure part of it is very important. Do you think in your professional experience that the courts would look slightly more favourably on a truncated discussion in an emergency situation, you know, for example?
So in an emergency situation, a doctor's overriding duty is to preserve life and prevent serious harm. So if you don't have time to go over the risks and benefits, if someone's in a cardiac arrest and you need to do something, then you have to act. And that is reasonable. And that's an exemption that the law recognises. If you do have that time available, or there's family members available, say the patient can't speak or they're unwell, but you've got patient family members and you might have a couple of minutes to have a chat, then do it. But if you don't, your overriding duty is to preserve that patient's life. If you can have a quick discussion, then fine, do it. But it's only what's reasonable in the circumstances. In those particular circumstances, your discussion is going to be quite quick. And the law recognises that. And what I would do as clinician, please always document what you've done, why you only had a quick discussion, and that will cover your back.
We'll probably circle back to the documentation, but thinking as well, just when we're talking to the patient in front of us.
Yeah.
Where do we stand with the patient that says, I don't want to know, just get on with it?
Patient has autonomy. And if the patient has capacity and says, I don't want to know, you as a doctor need to explain to them, but I am under an ethical and legal duty as your doctor to explain the risks, benefits and alternatives to you. You need to check that they understand what they are not willing to hear. Do you understand that you're declining to hear potential risks of this procedure? You need to check that they're understanding. And if they say, yes, I still don't want to know, then you can respect that patient's autonomy. But again, please write it down. Document that a patient did not want to hear the risks that you tried. You also check that they were informed, well-informed, in terms of they understood that they weren't willing to hear the risks. If there's any doubts about capacity or that person's being coerced, then that's a different matter. I would stop and probably wouldn't do the procedure.
When we're presenting options to our patients, can we present one option as being more favourable if it's what we would want done? Or is that coercive at that stage?
Only if that is what a responsible body of anaesthetists would do. So if a responsible body of anaesthetists would think that one option is more favourable than the other because it carries less risks, then I think that's reasonable. But then you would have to explain the risks and benefits of each option. And ultimately, it's the decision of the patient.
Say, for example, you know, we have a patient, they've got terrible lungs.
Yeah.
The operation could get done under spinal anaesthetic. Spinal would definitely be much safer for them, but it would be technically possible to give them a general anaesthetic. Can we include that then in our description?
Yes, definitely. And you should make them aware of that. But yes, okay, you may be awake, but ultimately the risk profile is much lower. You definitely should inform the patient of that.
Are people consenting to an anaesthetic as a whole package? Or are they consenting to, do we need to talk about individual parts of the anaesthetic when we're doing the consent process?
I don't think you need to go into technical detail. You need to provide a general overview of what the anaesthetic involves, the commonly occurring risks, any rare risks that may occur, and if there are any alternatives, what those are. But in terms of going through each and every step, I don't think so.
Mm-hmm.
That is not warranted. That's not needed.
And when we're doing an anaesthetic where we're putting somebody off to sleep, but we're also doing a regional technique, maybe a nerve block on their arm or something like that, do you think it's the idea that they could get their surgery without the nerve block and there's distinct complications that can arise from that? That's the reason we need to talk about that separately?
Yes, I think you do, because if there's additional risks attached to that particular procedure or medication that's being administered, then I would discuss that and explain it.
Mm-hmm.
That this is an additional element to the general anaesthetic or spinal that you're having, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Now, I come across an interesting case, and it was about whether or not you should discuss PR medicine separately. It's a well-recognised way that you can give medicine rectally when somebody's asleep. Is that something that we should consent for separately because of not the risks, but the intimacy associated with it?
I don't believe that you necessarily need consent, but I would definitely discuss it and inform the patient of it to give them the opportunity to raise any objections. And if they felt uncomfortable with that particular route of administration of medication, personally, I think you're undergoing a procedure. I think you've already consented them for the whole procedure and you've identified the risks and complications and benefits. I don't think you would need to necessarily consent that separately. But definitely inform the patient beforehand.
Now, of the things that we talk about with our patients beforehand, we're very focused on the sort of medical and anaesthesia side of things. But hospitals are teaching hospitals quite often as well. If we're supervising a trainee,
yeah,
where does that fall within the consent process? Is it an informing someone again? Is it very specifically telling them about the level of the trainee or how many times they've done this technique before?
But I think if you are supervising a trainee who is going to be actually administering treatment or anaesthetic, then you do have an obligation under Montgomery to get consent for that. For instance, I had a case which was a very complicated hysterectomy. Her bowel was basically adhered to her uterus. And she consented to that surgery on the basis that her consultant of a number of years was performing it. Unfortunately, the consultant was busy on that day and failed to inform the client. And his registrar did the surgery. Her bowel was perforated, which is a recognised risk of that kind of surgery. But the perforation wasn't detected for a number of days. And she suffered from a sepsis peritonitis and nearly died and ended up with a permanent stoma bag. And the trust actually quite quickly admitted liability on the basis that when she consented, she consented to the consultant, not the registrar, and to obviously the missed tear to the bowel, which was left for a good few days. In short, you do need to consent if you are supervising somebody who is going to be performing the procedure. If they're just supervising, I think you can inform, is it okay that my colleagues will be supervising today? That's fine. But if they're actually going to be involved in the procedure, because that could change the risk profile.
And I suppose as well, it does come down to this aspect of what is material to the patient.
Yes.
And the idea of trust as well, because presumably within consent, we try to explain as much as we can.
Yeah.
But there is always going to be an aspect of the fact that the person trusts you to do this.
Yes.
And it's a sort of ephemeral sort of bit that we can't quite quantify, but part of the consent is to you to do the operation or to give the anaesthesia. A bond has been formed.
And I think patients take that bond very seriously. From my side of the table, when a patient comes to us, But, you know, I formed a relationship with that person and they promised me that they would do it. And they put a lot of faith in that. So I think you just be honest and upfront about it. You know, I'll be there to step in if anything goes wrong and provide them reassurance that way and then see what they say. Some patients, I think, won't consent.
Now, this is quite interesting because the case that you described there, it reminded me of a case called Jones v. Exeter, which was similar in the sense that the lady had selected her surgeon very carefully.
Yeah.
And then that surgeon couldn't perform the operation. The bigger thing with that one was that was a change that happened on the day of surgery.
Yes.
And she felt at that stage coerced to carry on with her surgery, even though she wasn't happy with the person that was doing it. It wasn't her first choice. Now, anaesthetists quite often meet their patients on the day of surgery. Where
yes.
does that leave us if we introduce the idea of a spinal anaesthetic for the first time?
Obviously, it's common for anaesthetists to meet their patients on the day of surgery. The same legal obligations and ethical obligations apply. You still need to consent them under Montgomery, advise material risks, alternatives, benefits. Based on your conversation with that patient, if something else comes up and you think, actually, do you know what? A spinal is going to be much better suited to this patient because it's less risky, then you then have an obligation to discuss that with the patient and explain the risks and benefits of a spinal as opposed to a general anaesthetic. If the patient understands and is happy to proceed, you're fine. If the patient seems uneasy, not really sure, I would be really cautious and I would be thinking about, do we proceed today? Because do you actually have that patient's informed consent? You need to make sure that not only they understand, but they're happy to proceed and they're not feeling uneasy about it. They've got more questions. They're not really sure. I think if there's any element of doubt, I'd be hesitant to proceed because I don't know if you would have informed consent.
I suppose this really, again, comes down to the fact that we need to get our pre-assessment and our pre-op.
Yeah.
My understanding would be, in a legal sense, the ideal thing that we want to do on the morning of surgery is just confirm that everything as is.
Exactly. Ideally, you want your pre-assessment a few days before. That enables you to get more information from the patient, but also enables them to have a think about it and pull out if they want to.
I mean, ideally now with optimization lists and optimizing patients and things, we should really be pre-assessing our patients weeks before they come in.
In the ideal world, yes.
That's interesting as well, because again, it was a coroner's case, I think about 2 years ago. And one of the things they focused on in the pre-operative part was the use or lack of use of risk scoring systems.
Yeah.
You think that's something that we should be using more within our practice, not just saying there is a risk of death or there is a general 5% mortality for this surgery. Should we be trying to give the risk Montgomery style for the patient in front of us?
Do you mean before you even have the surgery? Is this amongst colleagues? So you have a scoring system amongst, you discuss a patient and you'll score their risk profile?
Well, sort of both. There are some risk profile scores out there that give you mortalities and complication risks. Should we be using them or discussing the risks generated from them routinely with our patients as well?
I think so, yes. Because if those scores are helping inform you of the risks and the advantages and disadvantages of a particular procedure, then I would say, yes, you must definitely discuss that with your patient under Montgomery and how that scoring system informs the risk. Because that may change the patient's mind. It may lead them to make a different decision. So I think it's important. And one of the things the GMC says is about sharing, sharing information and working together in partnership.
Now, we've done a lot of chatting about chatting and talking with our patient.
Yeah.
What should we be documenting? Now, I know that the simple answer is document everything, but that's just not practical.
No.
What would constitute something that would stand up in court?
ideally, if you're consenting, what you want to be documenting is the discussion you've had with the patient. And when I say that, anything in that discussion that they've raised about their own comorbidities or their lifestyle that's important, that would impact what kind of procedure or treatment you would administer. The risks you've explained, both rare and common occurring risks, benefits, any alternatives you've discussed, and making sure that you've got to make sure that the patient understands once you've discussed that, and then maybe saying that the patient has understood and accepted. Now, that sounds like a lot, and you would obviously have to do a quick, note, but that's really, you should really capture all of that. If you were to end up in litigation, for instance, a solicitor's going to be looking at the note, and a note that's got all of that written in it, you're well safeguarded. But a note that says discuss risks, tick, is not going to help you.
And again, from the minutiae of risks, there's no set percentage chance of risk as such we should discuss. It's what we think important to the patient in front of us.
What you think is important. So the identification of those risks is BOLEM. So what would a responsible body of anaesthetists identify as a risk, both commonly reoccurring and those that are rare? And then those to be discussed with the patient are those that are material, which again is the same, common and rare risks, and any that they would attach significance to.
Do you think we'll reach the stage where we'll be recording our consent conversations?
Possibly. I think medicine's going to move on, especially with the introduction of artificial intelligence. There's been discussions about recording surgeries, recording births. You would obviously need the patient's consent for all of this. But yeah, I think we could reach that stage. And actually, that may be a protective measure for both doctors and the patient.
You've talked about your legal experience. What are the sort of things from a consent point of view that you found doctors end up in court with or over?
Very often it's failing to obtain informed consent, which it could be inadequate disclosure of the risks. It could be failing to discuss alternatives. Cases can often end up in court because instead of performing some complex surgery, there may be some conservative treatment that actually can reach the same outcome. Usually they're the issues. I wasn't informed that there was a risk of an infection, for instance, even though we know that's a commonly side effect. You know, a patient may say that, but then it's the lawyer's job to prove that had they been aware of that risk, they wouldn't have consented to the surgery. So consent cases are not easy to bring. Mm-hmm. They're quite tricky because you need to show, not with a matter of hindsight, what the patient would have done had they been advised of that risk realistically, not now that the adverse outcome has happened, that they're now saying, actually, I wouldn't have consented. It's what would they have done had they been told there and then? Would they really have walked away from the surgery?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's quite a hard hurdle to jump, actually.
And do you think now with McCulloch that that's going to sort of bring Montgomery back towards the mean? As in, I think when Montgomery came in at first, there seemed to be a lot of consent cases out there.
Yeah.
And now things are maybe not quite as litigious.
I think McCulloch clarifies Montgomery, mm-hmm. and they're talking about two different things. And I think McCulloch is right. I mm-hmm. think treatment options, the identification of risks, investigation options are a matter of professional practice, not for lay patients. And the test should be, what would a responsible body of anaesthetists or other doctors consider to be reasonable? So I think that's correct. And Montgomery is correct in so far as what a patient should be advised. So I think they work together quite well hand in hand. I don't know if it will necessarily reduce the amount of consent cases. I personally think consent cases are quite difficult anyway, for the reason I said. I think it's quite a high burden to show that a patient would have done something different, especially if someone's in pain, for instance, a lot of pain, and they want that pain to stop and they're undergoing a procedure to try and stop that pain. You would really have to show that they would have pulled out at the last minute had they been advised of that risk.
And that's probably a useful one just as well, this idea of last minute changes of mind and things like that. If somebody withdraws their consent mid-procedure, My understanding is that you do have to stop, but you stop when it's safe to do so. Is that reasonable summary of it?
Because your overriding duty as a doctor is to prevent harm. So that has to come first. Then you respect the patient's autonomy. So you respect the patient's autonomy, but you have to make sure that they're safe first. Mm-hmm. And then you can stop. Yeah.
What about for the patient as well that has, we talk about not sectionalizing cases out, but breaking down into the individual parts of it. If a patient wants an operation, but say absolutely needs a fiber optic intubation, but refuses the fiber optic intubation, are you within your rights then to say, well, I'm not going to perform the anaesthetic as a whole because the conditions that you've put on me make it unsafe for me to do the procedure?
100% yes. If their refusal to consent to something, which they're well entitled to do, means that you're left with a very unsafe option, which you, as a medical professional, in your professional judgment, don't think is safe, you're well within your rights to say, I'm not proceeding.
And a final wee bit now on just thinking about the patient that lacks capacity. What's the role of advanced decisions or directives when it comes to surgery?
It depends. Do they have a deputy, a health and welfare deputy? Do they have a key worker? And what is your trust policy on it? What do they say as well? I think you need to consider those. If they've got a health and welfare deputy, then you would consult with them. Very often people don't have that. They'll have family members who are their next of kin who will help make best interest decisions for them. So it comes down to what's in their best interests. And that decision is made in conjunction with both the doctors and any family members or people that they've got supporting with them in consultation.
And when there's a disagreement then about what the best interests are, is that where the courts or hopefully maybe mediation or a second opinion would step?
Yeah, I mean, usually the first step we would hope would be mediation. I mean, either the hospital or, say, the trust or the family may instruct a solicitor, you'd end up in mediation. And then it could end up before the court of protection or judicial review, depending on where it goes. But yeah, that's when the courts have to step in and get involved.
Severin, it's been wonderful having this conversation with you today. And it's been great to speak to somebody that is actually there in court and knows what happens within court. If you've got one message or learning point that you want our listeners to take away with them around consent, what would it be?
Clear documentation, I would say. I'm a litigator, so I specialise in, you know, litigation. Hopefully it never happens. But if you were ever to end up before a court of law, the main thing a judge is going to look at and the solicitors are going to look at are the medical records, because that's all we can do at that stage. And a judges prefer contemporaneous records over what the claimant would say. So if you have got good record keeping, that helps and goes a long way. In terms of practicalities of consenting a patient, I know you have limited time. Do your best to elicit the information that you can, ask the questions that you can get the information, pointed questions, and do your best. Good luck.
Brilliant. Severin, thank you so much. This has been another episode of Anaesthesia On Air with our Ethics mini-series. I'm Paul McConnell. I've been speaking to Severin Ahmet. This episode will be available wherever you get your podcasts from. Please tune in. Take care, everyone. Bye-bye.